Hello and welcome to the Four Wheel Dive Podcast. The Drive and Dive starts now. Welcome. I am Tim Masso here with YouTube's original King of Cars, Kyle Lindsay. Folks, today we are discussing a topic near and dear to our hearts. It's the double-edged sword, how to buy old cars. We're going to share some guidance and questions to ask when buying used with classics, so pre-1980, Radwood, so like 1980 to 1999, and then modern era, 2000 to the present. We're talking about some buying experiences, mistakes made, lessons learned, all about PPIs, buying remotely, knowing your car, auctions, BAT. We're going to go over all of that. And I guess, Kyle, kick us off with classic cars, because a lot of what you do is the pre-1980 car in your shop. How'd you get into them? And just tell me about some of the first mistakes you made when buying a car pre-1980.
I got my love for classics from my grandfather. Classic guy, loved chrome, drove a Lincoln Town Car, Grand Marquis, liked the big stuff. And if it had a V8, it had to have dual exhaust on it. So basically, I have always had a love for classic cars ever since I was little, just because, you know, the styling, the feeling, the simplicity. It was, you know, vehicles were more of an art form back in the day, and, you know, safety and reliability and fuel economy and all that kind of stuff aside, there's just nothing that can replicate driving an antique car. But speaking from experience, they can become a headache real quick if you don't know what you're doing. And some of my earlier mistakes were just because I didn't know what I was doing. Unfortunately, especially when it comes to, you know, we talked about like the difference between like classic cars and vintage cars and what we thought, like, you know, different year ranges, you know, were classified as and so on and so forth. But when we're talking about older original stuff, let's say 60s, 50s, 40s, 30s and earlier get real specialty. So let's stick with the 40s, for example. I've got a 1948 Ford Super Deluxe. It is very, very near and dear to my heart. It's not exactly the one that my grandpa used to have back in the day, but it is identical. And I bought this car back, I think it was 2014. Made a video of it on YouTube and everything. It was awesome. It was an all original flathead V8. No rust, Southern car. I mean, you could almost get no better of a platform to do just a nice driver quality restoration. But the issue was, I didn't know what I was doing. So I would drive it around the neighborhood and just putt around real locally. But being that it was as original as it was, like wiring and stuff included, I started having just various issues start popping up. And then I had a pretty consistent vapor lock issue. And, you know, it burned me out real quick. So after tracking down this car and finding it, I only had it for about 6 months and I regrettably let it go. Fortunately, years later, I had the opportunity to buy it back with, you know, now having all of this wonderful knowledge I've been blessed with. And, you know, I still have that car and maintain it myself. And it's a much longer story that I'd love to share with you guys at some point, but that's the gist.
Yeah, we're going to do a car stories show sometime, and I think that one's going to figure prominently. I got a car story of my own about old cars, and before I jump into my Volkswagen Beetle that didn't quite happen, let me just say that we're not really going to talk about, like, super old cars. Like, once you get into, like, pre-1940s, you're looking at, like, Babbitt bearings and, you know, 6-volt positive ground electrical systems. You're looking at some cars that don't have brakes on the front wheel if you go back far enough, or engines that don't have separate cylinder heads. So we're going to stick to, like, you know, post-war when we talk about, like, classic cars, like 1945 to like 1979. So My first lesson learned in the old car space came when I was a kid. I couldn't even drive. Somehow, after looking at a 56 Packard that had been in a barn that burned down around it, that was like my bullet dodged, but the next bullet hit me squarely. 1968 Volkswagen Beetle. And somehow I convinced my parents to allow me to haul it home. Did not run, hole in the floor, all sorts of corrosion issues. And this is what I learned about old cars. You need the skills and the tool and the time and the space. And as a kid, I mean, like 13 years old, I had none of that. I talked to guys at the garage. They'd be like, yeah, just take the body off and, you know, start mechanically with the chassis. I'm sorry, take the body off? 900 pounds of like rotting body shell? How am I going to get it off? Where am I going to put it? I need two garage bays for one car. I realized that the Volkswagen Beetle has a semi-structural like floorboard, and it's not a body on frame car, so that rust through in the chassis was structural. It wasn't just a hole in the floor, it was actually the chassis being eaten away. Running boards were gone, but the real damage got in through like the sills. Doors rusting out from the inside, the vents for the engine in the back had allowed water in that got into the rear parcel shelf, and I had all sorts of mold growing back there. And between the rust and the lack of space to just take it all apart and lay it out, I was completely in over my head. I eventually wound up donating it to help finance the purchase of like my first car, which was an XJ Cherokee, which was a great car. But I don't know, I got like a $250 voucher or something for the Volkswagen. If I'd been smart, I would have parted it out. That would have paid for the whole Cherokee.
I got one even better for you. And I don't want to make this about stories and stuff, but
No, go for it.
I'm gonna make this a part of our conversation about make sure you look over what you're getting. Make sure you understand what you're getting yourself into. Let's say you may not have all of the mechanical knowledge in the world, and I certainly didn't for this next vehicle that I'm gonna talk about, but I had a better idea. This is after the 48, the first time I owned the 48. So my dad got tipped off from somebody that he knew about a 1957 Jaguar. I don't remember the model, or a Jaguar to our European viewers. This 57 Jaguar, it had supposedly been, you know, kind of resto modded in a way, updated here and there. It had a lot of new chrome. It had some new interior stuff. Sad story. The guy ended up, he had like stage 4 cancer, and this was his, you know, his pride and joy over the years. And they unfortunately had to sell it. So my dad and I went to go look at this car about an hour away from where I lived at the time. And it was pouring down rain, absolutely pouring. And when I first saw this car, I was like, wow, that thing is stunning. And for any of you familiar with the bodies of these cars of the era, I mean, just beautiful flowing lines. It kind of looked like a Bentley of the era. But anyway, so I looked this thing over real good and I was like, oh yeah, this thing is clean. Look at this. It had a Ford 3.8 liter V6 from like an 80 something LTD. So it was an atrocious dog of a car to drive.
Mongrel. Oh my God.
Terrible with 3-speed automatic. I drove it in the neighborhood. I was like, okay, it runs and moves. That's good enough. Still pouring down rain. I looked down at the sill and I was like, what's going on down there? I was like, there's definitely rust there, but there's these little button looking things and some metal that's been put down that sort of covers it. I'm like, what is that? So I was like, oh, whatever. I'll figure it out later. So anyway, I bought this car and I drove it an hour home. In the pouring rain, halfway home, the windshield wiper stopped working. And then when I hit the exit to get my exit to get home, you know, like five miles away, the brakes stopped working. So that was, you know, dodged a bullet there. But that's not it. I never looked underneath the car. I couldn't. It was too low to the ground. So one of the brake lines had busted. So I threw it full of fluid and limped it to the nearest shop. went back home, blah, blah, blah. They called me almost immediately when I got home and said, Mr. Lindsay, you might want to come and look at this thing a little bit more closely before we do anything to it. I'm like, what's wrong? They were like, just come. I kid you not, the entire bottom of the car was rotted away. And those little button things that I saw on the sill were rivets because somebody had taken flat sheet metal, bent it, curled it around to make a pseudo rocker panel all the way around the perimeter of the car, quarters, trunk area, tailpan, everything was this riveted on sheet metal. The frame was rotten. The body mounts were gone. I can't believe the body stayed on the frame. It was really bad.
Yeah, you're not kidding. So, I mean, I think it's a great place to start. Wow. We both had issues with corrosion in these first cars. We got in over our heads. And I think if my Volkswagen Beetle had just needed engine work, my dad, who had Beetles when he was, you know, a younger guy, could have helped me through carburetor rebuilds and oil changes and belt replacements. That wasn't a big deal. But let's start with no-gos with older cars. This doesn't happen with modern cars. But with old cars, for me, this is when you walk away. Extensive corrosion. Now, this could be a body shell. If you're talking about a body-on-frame car, like a 50s cruiser, like a 1956 Cadillac, or if you're talking about a 1966 Lincoln Continental, then you're looking at a unibody. And there were unibodies in the 50s and 60s. So you got to be really serious about this, since now rust is not just something that's going to be a pain to fix, but it could be structurally compromising. You want to look for previous evidence of bad rust repairs. Bondo can be an acceptable solution to plugging small holes in the body panel of a car. If it's well done, I don't object to it, but make sure it's not in a structural panel and make sure that the car is not more plastic than steel. So you want to look for evidence of bad previous repairs of rust. And Kyle, in your case, that bizarre, like circumferential rocker panel is a really good example of that. For me, rust is a reason to walk away if it gets past a certain point. How about you? What are your walk away points with like a classic car?
Honestly, with everything that I've dealt with in the last few years, rust is the number one. If you are looking to get a classic car and you don't already have all of the equipment that can be used to fix rust, I'm talking cutting, welding, maybe the most minor of body work just to prep it for a shop. Because not everybody has the ability to do everything. Unless you got all the stuff, do not do it. Step away. It sucks and it's unfortunate, but it is extraordinarily expensive to do for a shop to do a full-on restoration that involves heavy rust repair. My wife's Chevelle, for example, it's a 1969 Chevelle. It's a four-door, used to be her grandma's car. It was rusty, but it was not as bad as I thought it was until I peeled into it. When you see rust, it is worse somewhere else. I don't care what it looks like on the outside. If it's rusty where it's visible, it's more rusty where it's not. And a lot of the issues with these older cars, 50s, 60s, 70s, a lot of the trim that they put on these cars, like the stainless window moldings or fender moldings or, you know, stuff like that, and involves drilling clips into the body. A lot of times these clips and stuff were not, or not clips, but like screws and stuff, they weren't necessarily treated after the fact. They were just, you know, zip right into the body and call it a day. That's the first part that it rusts. So guess where the rust was worse on the Chevelle? All around the back window, to the point where I was able to just lift the window off of the car because the channel was gone after I took the trim off. And I'm still haven't fixed it yet. I'm dreading it. But rust is the killer. It's the number one killer. It's just like cancer. It just, once it starts, unless you cut it out.
Now, some cars are more prone to it, but even well-made cars that have previously had collision damage can be very susceptible. And remember, cars weren't expected to last as long back in the 50s and the 60s as they are today. So, you know, in the era before polyurethane clear coats and multi-stage paint, rust was very common after just a few years. which is why you have really low survival rates of old cars in, you know, the Northeast, for example, or the Midwest. They're all in Southern California. So for me, rust is a huge problem because it can be so endless. It can also be very insidious. You don't find it because it's in the floorboards. Or like Kyle said, it can build up around the rear window. Sometimes there's drainage systems that run through the trunk, and those can become clogged through the years, like an Oldsmobile Toronado 1966, 67. There are rubber drainage tubes that go through the trunk. The problem is they get backed up. They start to fracture as they age. Water gets into the trunk. They rust out from the inside. With that Volkswagen Beetle I had, the sills were rusted out. The area around the rear window was rusted out. The inner doors, lower doors, were all rusted out, and the floorboard was rusted out. And there's no reason to ever buy that car. I would say the only reason you ever buy that car is because it is so rare or potentially so valuable that no matter what you spend on restoration, you're coming out ahead. Like the Bugatti Voiture Noire, it's a lost Bugatti. And it's been estimated that if it's surfaced, it'd be worth maybe $100 million. So if you need to put $700,000 in that to literally recraft every panel, you know, good investment. But if you're looking at a 57 Chevy 210, and it's just a fun old car, and it's loaded with oxide, move on. Move on.
This 49 Studebaker that's sitting behind me, I bought it with no keys, with no title, which fortunately I was able to get a title for it. But because it didn't have keys, I wasn't able to open the trunk. And I'm looking around it. I knew it had rust, and you know, it's not. It looks worse than it is. But when I looked underneath the fuel tank and stuff, I was like, oh, it looks okay. You know, fuel tank's kind of eh, but you know, it looks okay. Kind of like the frame. You know, it's just got surface. Drilled the trunk lock, opened it up. The entire trunk pan was Swiss cheese because of the seals and stuff were bad, and it was just leaking all the years. So, like I said, it's there. You just got to look for it.
Yeah, so now there's another reason I would say walk away. If you are, we talked about having a wreck where the restoration costs are out of proportion to the value of the vehicle. Rust, which could be an endless goose chase. Incomplete cars. Now, here's the thing. I talked about that Chevy 210 with rust. That's actually not a bad car to buy if it's an incomplete but rust-free car, because you can open up a catalog and you can rebuild a 57 Chevy from reproduction parts. If your budget's a little bit higher, you can get OEM new old stock. Same is true for a 64.5 Mustang. Same is true for a GTO, stuff like that. But particularly with things like Chryslers, like Mopars, they are notoriously difficult to rebuild with parts. So if you're talking 50s Chrysler 300s, 1960s Chrysler New Yorkers, even certain muscle cars like a first generation Charger, the first generation Charger is not well supported. A lot of trim pieces, interior parts. If you need one of those fully electroluminescent Astrodomes on an early 60s Chrysler full-size car, you know, like a New Yorker, you're going to have trouble finding this stuff because there's no new old stock and there's no reproductions made. So look at this incomplete car and ask yourself, am I going to be able to complete it? Because if I've got missing modules in the dashboard or the dashboard shot and I can't get a place like Just Dashes to restore it, you might be able to buy the vehicle and it might be fundamentally sound, but you will never be able to get the body trim, the interior trim, pieces of the dash, different controls. I would also say, think of things like bumpers, and this kind of feeds into our talk on rust. Keep in mind just how expensive it is to re-chrome a bumper. Like if you've got a 57, 58, 59 Cadillac, pimply chrome might look pretty benign, but you're either going to have to replace them with new old stock or reproduction parts or pay tens of thousands to re-chrome them. So think about that. Not all rust is structural or body. It can be chrome that needs to be redone. And a lot of times trim pieces, especially when they are chrome, they are not available for cars that were not built in massive volumes. So keep all that in mind. Incomplete cars, not a fan.
That's a good point because, you know, even some stuff that's a little bit more common, we're rebuilding a 62 GMC C1000, which is the same thing as a Chevrolet C10, a little half-ton truck. But I didn't realize this until way into the build, but there are several aspects of the GMC that is unobtainium. it is extremely hard to find and difficult to work with if it's in bad shape. So like on these GMC trucks, the entire grill shroud is unique. Nobody repops a GMC grill. You can buy some little components, but you cannot buy the grill. Ours was mangled. We ended up having to do some real creative work, did some body work, ended up, you know, doing a paint job on it instead of chrome. It turned out really good, actually. But fact of the matter is, can't get the grill. So if it's in bad shape, you got to track down another one. The front nose of the hood is unique to GMC. The hood is the same as a Chevy, but not the very front of the nose. The dashboard is different. The tailgate's different. Some of the stuff you can get, dashboard parts, you can't get. So yeah, it's weird. So, you know, even if it seems like it could be a more common vehicle to find parts for, you got to still do your due diligence. If it's not like a full-blown mainstream brand, like, you know, not that GMC isn't, but if it's not Ford or Chevrolet or, you know, whatever, just look and see if anything's different and if it's hard to track down those different parts if they need to be replaced.
Yeah, 1957 Chrysler 300C, you get body trim, you probably can't. 1957 Chrysler New Yorker, you need body trim, you got a better shot. And these are the same body shell. These are vehicles that to most laymen look exactly the same. So if you've got an uncommon variant of a common car, double check to get double check to make sure you can get what you need. Now, these days, most suppliers are online. Even old mom and pop shops now list inventory. So you can find out pretty quick whether you're going to be able to rebuild this vehicle. So I stay away from incomplete vehicles and I rely on experts. Here's the thing. Carfax is not coming to your rescue with an old car. A lot of times these vehicles don't even have valid titles because states don't issue titles to a lot of old cars unless you have a continuous chain of custody and the title keeps getting reissued. You could wind up with a colossal problem registering the car wherever you are, but also realize that without any kind of history, Carfax, ownership history, service registration, you're going to be very dependent on people who are experts online finding one of those people locally to look at the car and making yourself an expert so you know what to look for yourself.
That's a good point.
So yeah, remember, there's a lot less database to help you out with these old cars. Also, be realistic. Can you do the work yourself? Like how much, if you're looking at a car that is going to require, I don't know, periodic valve adjustments, because a lot of old cars have solid lifters. Can you do that yourself or are you going to need a guy to do it? Figure out what your car needs, whether you can do it, and then budget accordingly, because you may have to pay for services that are unheard of on modern era cars.
Yeah, you can burn yourself real quick trying to tackle stuff that you don't have the experience to work on. Now, the way to learn is to do and to research and to get experience and stuff. But again, like Tim said, depending on the age of the vehicle and what it is and stuff, you know, try to befriend your local car folk, join some forums, join some Facebook pages. There's some haters out there that'll, you know, make fun of somebody trying to, you know, learn their way and stuff. But there are a lot of genuine good people out there still trying to help out as much as possible. So, you know, just remember, don't get too overwhelmed with it.
Yeah. And also another thing to look at with these older cars is whether they're being misrepresented. Because here's the thing, especially if you're looking at something that's really collectible, it's fairly easy to take a 1970 Challenger that was built with a 318 and a Torque Flight and turn that into a 440 with a six pack, a Hurst shifter, and a four speed. And you know, it's relatively easy to make those kind of changes. You can restamp blocks, you can restamp transmissions. If you start looking at things like, I don't know, ZR1 Corvettes, L88, L71s, all of a sudden you start looking at vehicles that are potentially worth enough relative to, I don't know, a C3 Corvette with a turbo hydromatic and a 350, you start looking at misrepresented cars that are relatively simple to reconstruct. Somebody could take a Series 62 1959 Cadillac and turn it into an Eldorado Biarritz. Now it's worth three times as much. So particularly if you're looking at something that might have been a 318, but now it's a 440 and there's like a four times price delta, really be careful there, because there are some scams out there that even once you get to the 1980s and 90s are no longer really possible due to the complexity of the car. So that's another reason to have an expert check it out, particularly if you're looking at something that might be matching numbers, really rare or collectible. If there's a much cheaper version of it that also exists, make sure what you're buying isn't actually that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this isn't a new concept. People have been doing tribute vehicles, let's call them, for the longest time, like tribute SS Camaros and Chevelles and so on and so forth. They're a dime a dozen all over the place. But just make sure when you're looking to buy, you know, something, that you're not paying SS money for an SS clone. It doesn't matter if it's got the same equipment. When you're paying that kind of money, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 plus, you want the real deal. You want the historical aspect in the papers, documents, whatever. But if you want to buy something a little bit more affordable and just have your fun with it and stuff and create what that car was for a fraction of the money, you know, you can do that too. But again, goes back to, can you do this stuff yourself?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know the questions to ask with these cars. If you ask someone whether his 1965 Oldsmobile Starfire is matching numbers, he's going to laugh, because matching numbers weren't a thing on those. So find out what the relevant questions are for the models you're looking into, and then ask those questions. That's really important. I would also say, we're kind of covering the classics the most because it's the toughest purchase to make. By the time we get to like modern era cars post 2000, that's really easy. There's not as much to worry about. But with like a modern car, it's like being a doctor trying to treat a human being. A human being can tell you a lot about his condition. We have Carfax, we have dealer databases, we have recent registration titles, all sorts of information. Whereas with an old car, it's almost like being a veterinarian and you've got a dog and the dog can't tell you what's wrong. And you've got to really know your stuff to figure it out. So, for example, with these old cars, what you really want to do with an engine that hasn't been apart in 60 years is make sure you get somebody to do a compression check and a leak down, because that is the closest thing you can find to an x-ray of the health of your engine that will tell you about cylinder heads, that will tell you about pistons and rings, that will tell you about, you know, head gaskets, valves, valve guides, that will give you so much information. And it's only going to cost a few hundred dollars. So that's definitely something you need to consider. Bring a magnet, check for Bondo, bring a flashlight, put it up on a lift. Don't buy any old car without seeing the bottom. Great photos, or better yet, check it yourself. Have a flashlight. Get intrusive. Get right in there. Take a look. All of this is super important. And I really cannot overstress the compression check in particular, because that is the bill of health for your engine.
I bought a 56 Ford Crown Victoria one time that what was probably one of the prettiest classics I'd ever seen. And it was restored probably 10 years ago. It was a beautiful car. I don't have it anymore. But, I drove it. Everything sounded all hunky-dory and stuff. And I was kind of blinded by the excitement of this just spectacular car in front of me, because I had told myself, you know, I'm trying to get out of restorations. I'm tired of doing it. The time, the money, the headache. I just want to buy something done. And this car was going to be my done. But, you know, I bought it. I drove it home. Put it on my lift. It's still hunky-dory. The next day I came into the shop, it had leaked every single fluid out of it, including gas. Every single thing was leaking. Oil, trans, coolant, gas, whatever. And it was a disaster. That car cost me months of time and stress replacing all the lines, redoing the fuel system because it wasn't factory, and, you know, just trying to make it better. And then I burned myself out on it. You know, the car was still beautiful. It was, when I got done, it was reliable, had a little oil leak. everything old has maybe a little oil leak, but I just got sick of it. It ruined the fun for me. So, you know, when you get underneath it and start looking at it for rust issues and structural issues, you got to start looking at, you know, fuel lines, brake lines, any of the soft components of these motors, because the gaskets on motors back in the day, especially we're talking about 70s and earlier, and the older they get, the worse they get. They're a combination of paper, cork, rope. I said rope, like tar impregnated rope or whatever you want to call it, for like
rear main seal or something like that.
Rear main seals, the stupidest type of gasket you can imagine for one of the most critical parts of an engine is made of daggum rope. And you know, the 48's the same way. It's got an oil leak. I know it's where it's coming from, but it's so hard to change. You just got to live with it. But
yeah,
it's just so
stressful. Imperfection. You got to be able to put up with compromises with old cars. You got to have a cell phone on you. You got to be ready to be stranded. Like there's a reason resto mods appear to be taking over. So you got to be ready to live with compromises on old cars. And frankly, you need to be more generous with your judgments. Like for me, a repaint that's well done on an old car, price of doing business. Original 1950s paint, almost unheard of. You know, things like alternators having been replaced. A carburetor that is correct, but the serial code doesn't match the build date of the car. Like, I'm fine with that. Has it been reupholstered? If yes, was it the correct trim? Was it the correct color? I'm fine. There are some guys who are going to be super sticklers about their F-code 57 Thunderbirds and their 1963 Z06 Corvettes, and they're going to be looking at serial numbers on carbs and alternators and power accessories. They're going to be crazy. But for the most part, with old cars, you're going to have to learn to live with these compromises, both in how they work and in how they've been kept alive for 50, 60, 70 years. Dual circuit master cylinder, it's wrong, but you better believe I want it. Like, things like that.
Right. There comes to a point where some things, I mean, it's not even a compromise. It's do you want to enjoy it? Yes, I do want to enjoy this car safely and reliably. There are so many instances where I stress originality. You know, got to keep it original. You got to preserve the history. And, you know, when you're looking at buying an older vehicle, yes, you know, on one hand, it's wonderful being all original. But on the other hand, it can lead to a whole host of headaches if it was not maintained in the correct way it was supposed to. Here's another just fast example. We've got a 56 Ford Thunderbird we bought from an estate sale. Completely original car, hadn't run in probably 2-3 decades. I got it running. Everything was great. Got it on the road, everything was great, but the more I ran it, the more I drove it, this happened, and this happened, then the trans started leaking, then this, you know, it's, you know, started having choke issues with the carburetor, then the radiator started leaking, then, oh, what is it now? Oh, now the brakes don't work. I moved it around the other day, and I have no brakes, so that's nice. But it's just, and then it becomes just like, I'm so sick of original. It's not even worth it.
Exactly. Like, I'm pretty cool. Unless the car is super valuable, if I've got the right block and it's matching numbers, but at some point a cylinder head was replaced, I'm fine. I'm going to live with that on a 63 Cadillac, you know, a Coupe de Ville. That's fine. That's
right.
So, you know, now we move to the, like, era of our lifetime, Kyle, which is, like, post-1980, what's often described as radwood because of the car show movement, the collecting movement. Now, I think the 50s were a real flowering of technology and change, but I would also have to admit that more probably changed in the 1980s than in any decade of the car industry until the rise of, like, electrics in the 2010s. The cars that entered the 80s were, in some cases, especially with American cars and British cars, almost exactly what was being made when, like, our parents were young people. And by the time you get to the end of the 80s, you have cars being made with technology that's similar to what we saw in the 90s when we were young people. And the 80s overlaps both ends of that. So, Kyle, talk about some of the more recent cars you bought from, like, the 80s and 90s and what you went through with that.
Oh boy. So I'll be the first to admit I love the 80s in for a lot of different ways. it was a very interesting time for the auto industry. Like you said, Tim, there was a lot of technology, a lot of innovation. We saw a lot of different fuel injection systems coming out. Manufacturers are starting to get real creative with incorporating like these trick digital instrument clusters. And, you know, even, you know, in the late 80s, GM had a touchscreen radio, a little cathode ray tube,
yes,
screen TV.
Buick and Oldsmobile. I know that thing. I know that thing.
I mean, brilliant little system if you ever get a chance to play with one. So there were an unbelievable amount of cool things, even performance. You know, the 80s is still riding the emissions train and the effects of the 70s and stuff. So performance wasn't like, you know, wild, but like by the mid 80s and late 80s, especially with like the Grand Nationals, turbos and stuff like that, you know, it started to cook up. But my most two recent 80s acquisitions that I no longer have, 89 Chevrolet S10, which we talked about in a prior episode. That was a resto mod, doesn't really count. But one of the biggest thorns in my side out of any vehicle I've ever owned was an 85 Chevrolet Monte Carlo SS. A ginormous pile of junk. This thing, and it wasn't...
How many of you really think of it?
Yeah, and it wasn't necessarily the car's fault. It was the guy that I bought it from, and it was my fault. By again, there's a theme here. Blinded by the excitement of, oh my gosh, I got the opportunity to buy a Monte Carlo SS. This is one of my dream cars. You know, this is great. Blah blah blah. I should have known when I took the test drive when it kept stalling on us that maybe I shouldn't buy this car. So, long story short, that ended up becoming a period correct resto mod, which I was very proud of. Stuck with a 305, but put a new one in there. Tune port fuel injection, world class T5 manual, so much fun. But my biggest issue with the 80s, the plastics, the materials, and the electronics, they are trash. They're absolute trash. Depending on the vehicle that you're looking for, you know, the 80s has become so much more popular and parts availability is massive, especially if you're talking Chevys and G bodies and, you know, stuff like that. That's the realm that I'm in. So that's what I'm more familiar with versus like the Mopars and Fords and stuff. But I will say, when you're looking to buy something from the 80s and early 90s, you have got to be mindful, not just of mechanics, not just because of electronics. Some of that stuff can be obvious. We're not even talking rust. Look for sun exposure. Look at sun damage.
Yes.
Look at how the paint is and how the exterior weather stripping is. If the paint looks baked, because there was still some single stage being used in that time, that can be okay. It can be normal for single stage because it to need to be buffed out over time. But you got to look at all the rubbers. If the outside rubbers look dry or, you know, God forbid, if they're cracking, look further. Look inside. Look at fabric and carpet sun damage exposure because, you know, just one little example, I did a detailing video on an 89-ish Chevrolet Beretta GT. Really neat little car. And I didn't realize this, but, you know, all of the interior panels, the dash, the doors, the rear panels, because the bread is a two-door, they're all covered in like a soft padding material. It's really nice. But the dashboard in this car was curled up and shrunk back 3 inches rearward where it was supposed to be. The door panels were, you know, starting to split and crack and stuff with all the padding and whatnot. And you will never find those pieces. You will have to get a whole new dashboard or, like you said, Tim, call a company that specializes in the reforming of that soft padding over those panels, and nobody's going to do that on a Beretta or whatever. It's just, you got to watch out for sun exposure.
Yeah, now we're in the Carfax era, post-1981, 17-digit VINs, but don't ever lean on that. Carfax misses a lot of stuff, especially on real old cars. The main reason I would ever even use a Carfax for a car from the 80s would be to see if the mileage is being updated regularly. If that's the case, fine. You still have to use your wits. You still have to have craft knowledge and understand your car. So keep in mind, there's going to be a lot of dead-end technologies in the 80s and 90s. Before OBD2 in 1996, there were all sorts of brand-specific and manufacturer-specific diagnostic systems. Some GM systems you could actually diagnose straight from the dashboard just by pressing a sequence of buttons. Others were sort of like pre-OBD2 that needed to be interfaced with a proprietary scan tool. In the 80s, at the same time, in the same decade, you had mechanical fuel injection, you had carburetors, electronic carburetors, throttle body fuel injection, and even port fuel injection towards the end. There is nothing like that in other decades. So know what you're getting into, because some of these systems were built for very short periods of time. 1981 to 1983 Chrysler Imperial, that is one of the only cars you will find with that fuel injection system. It was disastrous then. It is entirely unsustainable and serviceable now. Kyle is also right about interior trim and body trim. And I've got a great response that came to me from the Mercedes-Benz Classic Center in California when I was asking them about getting trim parts for W140 Mercedes-Benz, so 90s S-Class. Here's the thing they say. Trim and out, this is from them, Martin from the Mercedes-Benz Classic Center. Trim and outside pieces are usually the first to go. Smaller pieces are usually available, but eventually those go as well. Bigger units, like dashboard modules, console plastic, parts of the wheel, such as the center discs, interior trim, such as fabric, carpet, chrome, plastic, leather. These things tend to go after the exterior trim parts go. And we will advocate with Mercedes to try to get these parts reissued. But oftentimes, the best you can do is to go to an aftermarket supplier that specializes in parting out cars. So think about it. That's coming from the Mercedes-Benz Classic Center. That's not just the factory's response. That's the factory center that supposedly provides parts to old cars. They say interior parts are the first to sell out, followed by outside trim and electrical. In general, suspension and engine parts last the longest because they tend to be shared across models. Think about that before you buy a 1985 BMW E24 coupe that has a split dash, a fractured console, or maybe there's some veneer in your W126 S-Class that needs to be replaced. Mercedes-Benz itself, at the shop that restores Gullwings, doesn't have that stuff.
That is an amazing perspective. Thank you for sharing that, because I've always known that, like, just in my head, but I didn't know how to like phrase that to somebody. So that y'all go back and re-listen to that and write it down. That's really good information, because I can attest to that too. Not with a Mercedes, but my 89 Nissan 240 SX. I'm working on getting back to working on that car. And I bought that car back in 2016, and obviously it was already old by then, but it was a complete original car. Had a lot of great parts on it, but all the soft bits, all the exterior trim, weather stripping, yada, 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 was cracked and done. But incredibly, the dash was not cracked, which is almost unheard of in the 240 realm, especially this has a blue interior, so it's really rare. So I'm very prideful about my dash, but I collected parts for years. I even got some parts from Japan for like a Nissan 180SX, which is what the 240SX hatch was in the States. Basically, like for example, the trim that goes around the front windshield, not the glue, not the weather stripping, but the actual metal molding that goes around is discontinued. A lot of parts that I have gotten for this car over the years that were available from Nissan are discontinued. The back window trim, the metal molding, just like the front, That has been discontinued for years, but I found somebody on eBay selling a new old stock set still wrapped up. It was $500 some odd for frickin' metal trim, not including anything else to put this glass in. The quarter glass, on a 240 hatch, you can't buy the weather stripping for that. It only came on the glass itself from Nissan. So back in the day, if you busted your quarter window and were able to get a new quarter window, it would come with the weather stripping. So if your quarter window weather stripping on your 240 is screwed up, oh well. You either find a good set of glass and then find somebody skilled enough to pop it out, or you just deal with it. I've seen that. My point is, I've seen that over the years of available and then dwindle to where there's almost nothing left.
Yeah, and the crazy thing here now is that although these cars, we remember them from our lifetime, a lot of them are basically as orphaned as vintage cars would be, because after typically like 10, 12, 15 years, a lot of manufacturers will sell off their parts stores to aftermarket suppliers, which then warehouse them and sell them. They don't continue to produce these pieces in most cases. And particularly when you've got short-lived systems, there's not a whole lot of redundancy in the parts supply. Like an example, Aston Martin, if you remember back in the early 1990s, the evolution of the V cars, now you've got the Virage. Well, the Virage is a modern car. It's got port fuel injection, you know, four valve, four cam engines. It's got a Weber Morelli injection system that's only used on it. There is a separate ECU for each bank of the cylinders. And these ECUs live in the front bumper where they're subject to impact, water, environmental contamination, collision. So there is no redundancy for that system. Aston Martin is struggling to be able to provide service. And that's before we even get to the dashboard electronics in the Virage. Aston Martin might refer you to a guy who works in a shed and tinkers on microelectronics repair. But we're talking about a craft level company that's supposed to be able to service everything it's ever made because it was handmade. But by the time we get to the 80s, we are now looking at electronics that by definition can't be handmade. So with Aston Martin, if you need that veneer that you couldn't get for the Mercedes, you're probably okay. They can cut the wood, veneer it, finish it, ship it. But if you need those electronics, you are going to be barking up a creek trying to find them. Lincoln Mark 8 ECUs. I've seen Mark 8 scrapped because people couldn't find ECUs. We've got cars now that don't rust out, modern era cars, and they have to be junked because people either can't afford the ECU when they find it or they can't find it in the first place.
Dang.
I mean, yeah, and consider the increase in complexity. 1985 E24 BMW 6 Series, fairly straightforward. There's still electronics, there's still plastic and rubber inside and outside, like Kyle says. BMW Mobile Tradition will provide some of that. That's like the heritage arm of BMW. By the time you get to the E31 BMW 8 Series of the early 90s, now you've got two batteries, you've got two alternators, you've got two of everything in a car that uses local area networks to interface its systems with each other. You've got local area networks that are not hardwired together that need to communicate. You've gone one generation of car, but we've jumped from the Bronze Age seemingly to the Space Age. Be ready to handle these systems. That's why I say the more complex the car, the more worthwhile it is for you to buy the best example possible that needs nothing.
And then at that point, you're still better off buying a parts car too. I mean, for those who don't know, my YouTube channel, Saab Kylo 4, came from my first car, which was a Saab that I got in 2004. It was a 1997 Saab 900 SE 2-liter turbo convertible. It was a really cool car for high school days. But I only had that thing for a year because of the amount of times that it was in the shop. And again, this was 2004. Saab was still well in business. You could still get top motors and all that kind of stuff, which was one of the issues that I always fought, the tonneau motors for the top. So anyway, that was, you know, that was then. I decided to relive my Saab days of, I don't know, 10 years ago. I bought a 95 900 convertible that was the exact same, except it had the awful 2.5 liter V6 instead of the cool Saab 2 liter turbo motor. So that was the only Achilles heel. That car had transmission problems, tonneau problems. I was able to get some of that stuff fixed, but like even down to, and again, this was before I really knew how to do any kind of mechanical work. I had valve covers leaking, all sorts of, you know, stupid little service stuff, you know? And, I took it to, as an idiot, I took it to the Saab, or former Saab, the Cadillac dealership, and had freaking valve covers done on a 95 Saab, which I they were like, wow, look at this sucker coming in here. So not only did I get raked over the coals on that, but, you know, they were like, oh, we're having a hard time finding valve cover gaskets for this Saab, which it's like an Opel motor or whatever. I'm like, you can't get valve cover gaskets for a 2.5 liter V6 from the 90s? What?
It seems like a modern car. It seems like parts should be self-evident.
Right. So I think they got some like aftermarket cork crap and got it fixed. But I was like, all right. So I sold that Saab, and then I bought another one just because I didn't have enough. And we're going to talk about this more in our next episode about cars that we will never buy.
Oh, yes.
But just real quick, so I bought a 2001 or 2002 Saab 9.3 Viggen convertible, the good Saab.
That's black. Actually kind of cool, I gotta say.
Oh gosh, I got a video of it on YouTube. Sick car, black on black, it had super low miles, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna keep this car for a long time. Within a couple weeks of buying it, I went to the garage, opened up, and I was like, huh. That's a big puddle of transmission fluid underneath there. So, it sprung some kind of leak. I don't remember what it was, but at that point, I was like, I'm done. Forget it.
So now you wonder where his name and his internet handle came from. Now you know a little bit more, but we'll talk more about that in our next episode. I will never. That is our next episode. You know, another thing you got to really think about with these 80s and 90s cars, in addition to getting parts, can you still get tires? You'd be surprised how many 80s and 90s cars no longer have the original tires made in the correct size. That's why a lot of like Viper guys put generation 3 wheels on generation 1 and 2 Vipers. And up until recently, if you had an old Lamborghini LM002, the Pirelli Scorpions that you needed to put on that unique wheel hadn't been made since the 80s. And although that's an extreme case, it's not the only case I've heard. Like, it's not just exotic cars. If you want to get the correct tire for your wheel, if it's even somewhat unusual, a car or a wheel size, make sure you can still get them before you take the plunge, because that is a concern. Now, in this era, tools you're going to want to have an OBD scanner for basic stuff on post-96 cars, because once we get into this era, there's really no exemptions. You're probably going to have to pass emissions. Most of those classic cars pre-1980, even California gives you a pass if your car is 1975 or older. But if you're looking at 80s and 90s cars, chances are most places that do inspections, that have state-required inspections, they're also going to require a state emissions pass. And OBD is not going to tell you, for example, whether your AC or your active suspension or your climate control is working properly, but it will tell you if your emission system is screwed up. So that's something to consider. OBD scanner. Also important, paint meter. For me, a go, no-go in the era of two-stage paint where you've got clear coat and then base coats, broken clear coats and resprays. I won't buy a 90s car that's been repainted. So for me, a paint meter is important. And what you're looking for here is not just depth. That's important. But for the most part, you're looking for symmetry. Side to side, front to back. You're looking at horizontals being similar. You want to make sure that there's not some huge asymmetry, like one fender that's got twice the paint thickness of the rest. Or tape lines inside the door jams. You got to be smart about this, but I don't tolerate paint or rust on like a modern era car. And I think 80s and 90s is modern era. Be real careful on that too, because these cars still rust out in the Northeast. And there's a lot of cars that have had a very cursory repaint over rust. When I was in boot camp, I had a buddy and we got Liberty after like several months. It was a great day. We were driving his car away from the seawall in Newport, Rhode Island, where the car had sat next to the freezing surf with the waves crashing against the seawall in the parking lot. We got about a quarter mile down the road from the lot in his 90s Ford Contour when one of the suspension uprights in the front of the car went through its strut tower, popped the hood. The sills of the car started dragging and sparking. He pulled into the gas station on base, handed the keys to the guy at the station, abandoned it in place. This happened on a car made in the 90s. So you really got to be careful. It can happen here too.
Jeez. Woo.
He bought a 5-liter Mustang though, so it all worked out.
That's really cool.
But yeah, you got to be really careful because these cars, these 90 cars, they will rust. And when they rust, people are a lot less tolerant of repairs than if, say, it's a properly repaired 1967 Corvette.
This is true. I did a little bit of rust repair on that Monte Carlo. I had a 96 K1500 that had cab corners that I didn't fix. I was just like, nah.
And, you know, the other thing, too, for me is, like, dirty cars. Like, when you do a full body-off restoration of an old car, you're going to clean it up. You're going to have the chassis media blasted. You're going to powder coat. It's going to be real nice. But, you know, with a 90s car, an 80s car, you can keep it clean, but you can't make it clean. If you put it up on a lift and the bottom's boogered from 70,000 miles driving around in New York or Long Island or Rhode Island or Massachusetts, short of taking it apart piece by piece and spending tens of thousands of dollars that the car is not worth, look for something that's southern, western, southwestern, hasn't been driven in the rain, hasn't been driven in the slush, has never seen road salt, because particularly here, it becomes very tough to do a restoration on a modern era car. So you can keep them clean, but you can't make them clean inside. Yeah, too.
That's a good point. Yeah, I know we're kind of getting close to our time ending today, but I wanted to try to feed in there. You know, what if somebody is buying a car sight unseen online, whether it be eBay, Bring a Trailer, Cars and Bids, Haggerty, whatever. You know, just speaking off a little bit of my experience using multiple platforms over the years. Let's say you've passed everything from, you know, I know what I'm getting myself into. I know about the background of this car. I know the problem areas that might need to be addressed. I know that I can get parts for it and so on and so forth. But how do you know that you're getting a good car at the end of the day? You got to be careful with the seller that you're dealing with and how the car is being presented. Yeah. You were talking about misrepresentation earlier, but it can go so much more than just, you know, not being the right, you know, number code on the engine or something. I mean, the way something can be detailed or photographed or, you know, a little bit of rattle can on something here and there on the chassis, you'd be surprised how much that can change the demeanor, let's say, of the vehicle via photos and video and stuff. So, you know, for me in developing my trust in buying certain, you know, just a handful of things sight unseen, was the quality of the listing, the site that's presenting it, and how much the overarching site has to do with managing the listings. That's what I like so much more about, like, Bring a Trailer and Cars and Bids versus eBay, because eBay is a very, very large platform that, again, a lot of people and professionals use. But I've seen there's a lot of amateur stuff going on eBay as well that's kind of, you know, not policed, so to speak. But with sites like Bring a Trailer and Cars and Bids, your vehicle has to be submitted. You go through a vetting process. They have to even want to do it in the first place, but then you almost kind of have to prove the vehicle's worth by providing documents or a build sheet or so on and so forth. And then you provide several hundred photos that show the vehicle. But you know, building trust with something like that is very, very hard. but you know, finding a site that has that much to do with the vehicles that they sell also helps give you a lot of confidence.
Yeah, without a doubt. And, you know, always read the comments below an auction when you're on Cars and Bids or Bring a Trailer, because that's where the experts hang on. A lot of those guys are gadflies who don't buy anything, but they do know their stuff and they'll point out the problems you might not know about. So a couple of general pieces of guidance for like buying a car. We all know pre-purchase inspection by someone who knows what he's doing. Anyone who won't allow a pre-purchase inspection, that's a seller you don't want to do business with. And frankly, anyone who says you can send your guy, but he can't drive it, if they're opposed to letting a professional mechanic drive the car around the block, again, look elsewhere. Also, if you've got a car that seems like it's really low miles and it's a modern era car with a 17-digit VIN, I talked about using Carfax just to track history, not so much collision and repairs. But if you got a really low mile 1990s like S600 coupe, because I love those, I'm always looking at those. Well, okay, 23,000 miles is really low. If this is in a state that does inspections and requires it to pass emissions, has it gradually added miles in between every inspection over the years? Did it go 10 years without adding any miles? If there's some weird gap in there that doesn't make sense, then you need to be suspicious. If it's just something that a widow drove to church every Sunday for 27 years, you're probably in the clear as long as the Carfax shows gradually increasing miles adding up to whatever the currently represented number is. Now, another thing that's important, like Kyle said, is good photos. And you want photos from the underside of the car on a lift. If he's just sticking his phone under the car, that's not enough. You either don't know enough to explain your car competently, or you're trying to hide something, or you're just lazy, in which case I don't want to buy my car from you because you're probably lazy about maintenance. Another thing that's important, Photoshop is now everywhere. Let me give you an example. I once looked at an Audi S8 because I love these stupid D2 Audis, and it actually looked pretty clean in the photos online. But when I actually went to look at the car, I found that there were tears in upholstery, there were dirt marks on carpet, there were cracks in veneers and in the dash, and that these things were not present in the corresponding photos online. Photoshop is everywhere in car photo listings. Be on alert. If you have suspicions, this is what you do. You don't call the salesman you're working with because he knows you're onto him. You call and ask for some other salesman. Could you get me some phone photos just so I could see better? Ask for something like, could I see whether the digital displays work on the radio? And in the process of taking that photo of the dash, you see whether there's actually a crack in the veneer, a hole in the upholstery or in the trim, because phone photos are hard to edit. Whereas if you're taking photos with a camera or you're taking photos with a phone and putting them through the editing process and their landscape rather than portrait, get them to give you an impromptu photo. And that's usually where you can catch them. Now, Kyle was talking about rattle can detailing of the chassis. Here's a great example. One of the best things you can do in the era of the internet is take a car's VIN and track its listing history. If it's a low mileage collectible, like say this is, I don't know, a 1951 Chrysler New Yorker, Hemi, first year for power steering, really cool car, low miles, claimed to be all original. Well, a place called, I'm not going to name the place, but a place in the Midwest had it, and it looked supernatural underneath. But when I took the VIN, not a 17-digit VIN, just an old-school VIN, put it into Google, I was able to find two previous shops that offered that car, because a lot of these collectible low-mileage cars, they bounce around. And one of them had chassis shots. The chassis looked like an honest 70-year-old car. There was evidence of corrosion. Some of the original undercoating was still there, but not much. There was some dirt. It wasn't antiseptic. But the final dealer that was offering it years later, the chassis was as black as the night without a moon. The exhausts were supernaturally white silver. It was so obvious that somebody went in there with basically spray paint cans and painted the chassis black, and the axles and the suspension parts and the springs, masked off the muffler, and then separately masked around the muffler and painted it silver. The second you see that, run screaming, because you can't trust anything else they're going to tell you. And I've even seen it on Bring a Trailer where someone took like a Northeast driven Lincoln Town car and did an awful rattle can spray paint job where you could actually see the gaps in the spray around the muffler. And I was just like, palm to face, you got to be kidding me. Rattle can detailing of a chassis is very real.
Wow. Gosh.
Yeah, track these things, though, through previous dealers. If it's a really specialized, special interest car, like right now there's a dealer in Beverly Hills offering Michael Jordan's S600 Lorenzer. That car has been offered before. You will be able to find past listings and auctions for it. There is information out there. So, Kyle, we now bring the modern era into the frame, and I think this is the easiest one. Post-2000, these cars are a lot easier to shop because, for the most part, they're modern used cars. How do you approach this?
Honestly, if you're on a test drive, you could pop into your local O'Reilly or whatever auto parts store and just have them put in a diagnostic scan tool and check for stored codes. Because, I mean, aside from everything that we've talked about already between, you know, electronics and mechanicals and bodywork and stuff like that, all of that's pretty universal for the most part. But, you know, in an era where everything is electronically controlled, from the powertrain to the body control module, I mean, transmission, everything, you can clear a code a lot of times. And if it's a good scan tool that you hook up, you can see stored codes and see, you know, basically like the ghost of what was there. Even though it's not actively as a warning code, it had a history of said warning code, and you can be like, huh, hey, what was that? You know, that has been an invaluable resource for me over the years. And you don't even have to spend a whole lot of money. You can get something cheap on Amazon. I mean, just have something that can just give you a little bit more peace of mind that, okay, you know, all systems check out, seemingly.
Yeah, in the 90s, if you have OBD2, you can find out if the car is going to pass emissions. By the time you get to the 2000s, you've got scan tools that can tell you which one of your rear bumper backup sensors is out. It can tell you which one. These scan tools can go so deep, suddenly things like Carfax become a lot more relevant because the cars don't have as much history. There's more resolution in the record of the car's maintenance and collision history. Dealers suddenly become a lot more helpful because a lot of them have those proprietary scan tools that can tell you everything you want to know about every part of the car. And a lot of them, like Mercedes, depending on which Mercedes dealer you go to, if the car's always been serviced at Benz, a Mercedes dealer anywhere should be able to tell you what's been done to a modern era Benz since the 2000s. I don't just mean oil and filter, but everything that's been done in their database. Also, if you get a good independent garage with a factory scan tool emulator, there's this thing called VAG.com. It can test basically any Volkswagen Group car, whether it's a Volkswagen or a Bugatti. It is a synthetic scan tool that can go as deep as the factory tool and find all of those individual things, like which sensor in your power seat is out that's causing it not to, you know, reach the correct memory position. And with these hugely computerized cars, having those ultra deep scan tools suddenly makes the dealer relevant again. I don't care what a dealer has to say about a 1965 Cadillac. I really do care if I'm looking at like a $70,000 second generation CTS-V wagon. All of a sudden, the dealer becomes very, very helpful.
Absolutely.
CPO, extended warranty, buy the best one. A lot of these cars, you can still buy them certified pre-owned. A lot of them that aren't CPO still have some sort of factory extended warranty. And even if it's not bumper to bumper, there's probably rust through or powertrain on that car if it's less than 8 years old.
Good point.
Also, I would say realistically, this is where you have to consider running costs because there's no way you're going to put a GTR on classic insurance. You're going to pay a crazy insurance premium for that thing, which is different from the Radwood cars, different from the classic cars. And for me, it's either paint from the factory or drop dead. I will not tolerate paint on a car less than 30 years old.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And I would also say this as a parting shot, make sure it hasn't been flooded. There have been a lot of big floods, hurricanes, apocalyptic events in the South, Florida, New Orleans, Mississippi, Alabama. There are so many Katrina cars still floating around. And with every hurricane that comes, Ida, Ike, you name it, there are more of these vehicles. Superstorm Sandy, if it's the Northeast. So be really careful about that. And again, these are modern cars. You should not accept a compromise. treat it like you're buying the best used car possible, and you probably can't go wrong. You're less reliant on experts now, but the cost of making a mistake is much higher.
Absolutely.
These cars are essentially unrestorable. Stay away from early EVs and hybrids. That's just my advice. Parts aren't available, and particularly with Tesla, you might think it's cool to own a first-year Model S, but when Tesla either won't sell you the replacement battery or will sell it to you without a warranty, you realize the kind of hazard you're taking on. I think right now, those are not classic cars. Avoid those like the plague. That's just me.
Certain things just aren't worth fixing this day and age. And, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see how the next 10, 15 years go with, you know, how some of this new age tech is going to age.
Yeah, like in the same email from the Mercedes Classic Center, they told me most Mercedes dealers, frankly, will not touch a pre-2005 car. So consider how fast the technology is moving. It may look the same to you externally, but every 18 to 36 months, the company may be upgrading its code, going to a new generation system bus, or an all-new programming language, which means even though this car may be only 5 years older than the one before it, the difference between a 2006 Mercedes and a 2001 Mercedes may be to the extent that the mechanics no longer even understand how to work on them. If you went into a Chevy dealer with a 1950 Chevrolet in the year 1960, they could do everything to that car. But technology moves fast today, which is why I say consider every car made since 2000 to be basically recyclable. Maintain it, because you cannot restore it, and you may never be able to restore it.
That's a scary thought.
It really is. So the lesson here is take a deep breath, make yourself an expert, and buy the best cam in block two valve 50s or 60s American car you can find. That's the rest of my case.
Old school. Yay.
Kyle, where can they find us online?
I am SobKyle04 on YouTube and SobKyle04 LLC on Instagram and Facebook.
And I am Tim_Masso on Instagram. Thanks for driving and diving with us.